reconvene.
Commissioner Crawford, you have a question?
I had one small one, has anyone actually counted what goes on in the Narragets Road at the moment? Do we know what the traffic generation is and what, say, you know, when you look at the peak period, how many people come out of that area? I'm just curious, you know, I'm calibrating models of mixed reality.
Yes. Jack's Point residents and owners association do have a traffic counter site immediately inside the Narragets Road.
Oh, they do?
Yep.
Okay.
I could elaborate, but I'm not too sure whether I'm allowed to or not.
Well, then give me
a... Essentially, Jack's Point's there or thereabouts 400 residential units at the moment, and that's made up of about 300 houses and about 100 building sites, active building sites at the moment. So it's theoretically quite busy. The current traffic looks to be, you know, similar to what housing, what 270 houses would generate, sort of thing. So at the moment, it's generally generating significantly below what you would anticipate for that many houses. Whereas Lakehead Estate, say, is pretty much generating the amount of traffic you'd expect for the 500-600 odd dwellings down there.
Okay.
So essentially, yeah, it's Jack's Point is, as far as the residential area, is probably about half full, getting close to half full, and is significantly down on what you'd expect the traffic from that many residential buildings. And now that could have something to do with and Jack's Point also do a census of their occupiers or homeowners members, I suppose. Which shows that there's a fair majority or fair proportion of houses that are holiday places as well. So about 30% of completed houses, roughly, are holiday places. So that's a rough breakdown, I suppose, where Jack points at. Partially told to you as a traffic engineer and partially told to you for the information that I know is from living there, so, yep.
Two areas of expertise.
Well, yeah, theoretically the only one that I should be talking to you about.
Okay. And my second and final question, the one I put to Mr. Gatsby about Coneburn was to become an industrial estate. Have you considered the implications of that when you were looking ahead to 2045?
Not really. For Coneburn, I've relied upon the Queenstown QLDC NZTA traffic model for the state highway. The discussions that I've had with NZTA, they're very happy with that approach. They have, you know, that model has been developed by Rationale, who undertook the growth strategy, and from that it went to Abbey Transportation Consultants or Transport Planners, who can then throw traffic numbers at that projected growth. So, certainly NZTA have no problem with using it. They feel that that's a realistic expectation of what traffic is going to be on the roads based on the current.
Based on the land uses that are reasonably foreseeable, but that doesn't take into account Coneburn.
So it doesn't take into account Coneburn, and it doesn't take into account a lot of what we're looking at today, because planning may enable that, but it's not committed to the network until you get further down the line, essentially, as far as NZTA
Does it take into account hand-me-downs?
Yeah, but to a very small degree, and that was one of the criticisms that I... with particularly Ms. Banks' rebuttal evidence and she did provide a table of how many thousand there could be in that area compared to how many I considered within the model.
Okay, and my final question, the new shiny bridge.
interesting. And I suppose when I pan back a little bit to the earlier question about traffic at Jack's Point, peak hour Part of what you'd expect for, say, 270 residential dwellings at the moment. Perhaps some of that is because people don't choose to travel the same because of delays at the bridge. Whereas you get that bridge becomes a shiny new beautiful one sometime around March next year, and perhaps that will mean that there might be some trips that are currently suppressed would happen. Perhaps we wouldn't. People would pop to the supermarket to get milk and eggs instead of, you know, use those trips up that they didn't really think twice about at the moment. But in saying that, October is when the bus route starts operating at Jack's Point as well. So, you know, one could neutralise the other. It's, you know, I suppose it's speculation on what could happen.
Thank you. That's me done.
Just one thing really on the model. He's well, adopted Mr. Carr's figures, I think, and he uses a trip generation, a very fairly traditional peak hour 0.9.
Yep.
Per dwelling per peak hour. Now, I would have thought a place like Jack's Point, and you may be able to comment on this as a resident, that there might be a higher proportion than usual of holiday homes and retirees and work from home types, and doesn't really generate, or likely to generate that.
Looking at the numbers I've seen from the traffic counter, Jack's Point would be generally lower than that. But I suppose for the simplicity of argument, and if something's been suggested, why not just use it? It provides a more robust case than my...
It's robust in the sense that it's worst case.
Exactly. So if anything, I believe that the 0.9 is an overestimation, but it is used a lot for whether it be... And Andy, Mr. Carr... suggested in his own evidence that it was used for Northlake, it was used in other locations as well, and it's exactly the same as what the Queenstown and QLDC NZTA traffic model used for Homestead Bay intersection. And they essentially model all of Jack's Point zone coming out through one access being Homestead Bay.
Now, and it's also used in massive new greenfield subdivisions in major cities.
Yep, all around the edges of Christchurch and that sort of thing.
It's very good.
And so, yeah.
Where it probably isn't a lot more realistic.
Yeah, whereas here it's, yeah, possibly, I would suggest it's probably an overestimation, but it creates a robust case to say that these accesses can be provided. And I suppose the distribution was also Mr. Carr's suggestion of distribution percentage out of the development in the AMP and percentage out of the development in the BMP was exactly the same as what was in the NZCA QLDC traffic model as well. So, essentially for me, it's like, well, why don't we stick with what is agreed, suggested, used elsewhere, regardless of whether it's an overestimation or whatever. It makes life a lot easier. Path of least resistance, I suppose you could say. And given, and hence that's also one of the 2045 through traffic on the State Highway as well. It's hopefully that ahead of where we're really realistically going to be looking.
Well, if I was an economist, I might start wondering about economic efficiency, but I'll make sure I do it there.
Yep.
In your evidence on page 5, but it's also in your summary, similar conclusion, you concluded that in either scenario, some approvals were required from third parties.
Yes.
What would be the outcome if those approvals were not obtained?
Well, that would prevent further development beyond what is able to be done in the operative district plan, really. Now, we're talking about two road networks that are managed outside of the council's typically way of managing these road networks, that they're effectively private third parties. Obviously, NZTA have a number of rules and regulations that they need to stick within.
So if the approvals weren't obtained, the lane wouldn't be suitable for development from a traffic engineering point of view, is that what you're saying?
Basically, yes. You wouldn't be able to keep your vehicles in and out.
It raises a question, but it's not for this witness, about the activity status that's proposed around that.
The other question I had, and I think it's raised by NZTA in their evidence, is about the proliferation of axes off the state highway. Is there any reason why N-Zone couldn't have their access through the internal roading of Homestead Bay?
No.
And so their access off the state highway could be replaced effectively?
There's no reason why it couldn't be replaced. Initially, I did look at that as a potential second access, I suppose, but at the actual location of that registered crossing point, the easiest place to start, the visibility to the south are marginal. There's essentially a crest curve or summit curve that you can't see out on.
Okay, thank you very much.
Named Woolshed Road across from there, but it's not hatched green. That's stopped road, so it's no longer road. It's been joined to the Jardines title. And that was the old legal road alignment. So there was an exchange under the Public Works Act for a piece of Maritat Road in return for Woolshed Road.
Yep. Okay, and the legal road running through the Jack's Point part is
still legal,
totally unformed and unusable.
Yes, and so
it goes through the golf course.
That's right, and the Marajack Road is not coloured green because it's private road.
Yes. So the Marajack Point is public road on the Jardine property.
That's
or
correct.
Adjoining Jardine property.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
As far as I know, there's no legal reason why the council couldn't form Woolshed Road. Well, that would be quite a revolver for them.
To be the level of seriousness, too.
Right, so with that piece of background done, so effectively we're confirming that the boundary positions shown on the plan that's attached to my open submissions is correct.
No, it's wrong.
There we go. So, could you take the commissioners through your summary statement?
Yep. So that's it. There's just a couple of items in Ulrich's evidence that I'd just like to make some comments on. Probably point two in response to comments of error 3.5. Ulrich was not certain that there was enough land for disposal of wastewater to ground. According to the low environmental impact report, applying the same factors and calculations to service the newly zoned area would require approximately 14.3 hectares of land. And on the attached plan, there's an area in green that's on a suitable contour geology that we would be able to dispose of wastewater to that land. And it's approximately 30 hectares in area. So I'm satisfied that if we were to dispose of treated wastewater to the ground, that would be a suitable land application area of suitable size. And further in response to paragraph 3.6 of Ulrich's evidence, I can confirm that we have complete investigation to connection to hand-me-downs and tax point systems, and they have not been discounted. There has been ongoing dialogue, particularly with tax point and Coburn Water, etc., over a number of years. In fact, some infrastructure has been installed in Maori Jack Road extension in the Jardines land with anticipation of connection, but that hasn't come to fruition. Of course, discussions would continue if connecting to those schemes was still considered to be the best option for servicing the land. At the moment, obviously, we've been considering all of our other options to see that we get the best available to us. And the final comment I have is in response to Mr. Glazer's 3.7, 3.9 in relation to potential contamination effects of the new water supply. Unfortunately, we don't have a full aquifer analysis available. It's likely to be in the next 2 to 3 weeks. In the interim, however, I did ask the question of our hydrogeologist if there were likely to be any effects on the bore. His preliminary advice is that it was unlikely, provided we have a robust design for the disposal of the treated wastewater to ground. Obviously, the full report would be available shortly, and be available for everybody to consider.
You've talked about this having the availability of 30 hectares for wastewater disposal. What would the total nitrogen disposal for this population be per hectare per year?
The figures for that I don't think kept with me there in the low environmental impact report. So they've assessed what the nitrogen loading would be based on different treatment options. A near report concludes that treatment would comply with the regional council requirements for discharge.
Is that report prepared based on the present requirements of change 6A to the water plan? Or does it predate that?
Good question. I can't answer that one. That'd probably be one I'd have to ask Rob Potts to confirm with any certainty.
It's pretty we don't have Mr. Potts here, really.
This report was issued in May 2017, so it's reasonably recent, but it doesn't specifically say whether he addresses the...
No, it doesn't. I couldn't find it. I think I get the idea there, rate of mercury vehicle was, or potential effects of that, other than the obvious health effects which concerned.
Can I tease out your question a little bit? Are you wanting to know whether it would meet the overseer load numbers that would apply from 2020 onwards, or are you asking whether Mr. Potts has assumed that the standard to be met is the standard which applies today, as opposed to 2020?
Both of those, and in addition, whether the nitrogen loading would actually have no effect on the natural character of the lake. And the overseer modelling is designed for farming. It's actually for wastewater treatment. It's much easier to calculate than using overseer. But that does, if that is a factor that I don't think has been considered, is the nature of the treatment required to minimise the nitrogen loading. And that's why I was asking those questions.
Yes.
I don't think the loan report has looked at it in that respect, and they've looked at a much smaller number of houses which would have a much smaller impact.
Yeah, on the design of the treatment and the disposal beds, particularly to remove the nitrogen, would possibly have to be to a higher level.
Well, you don't remove the nitrogen through disposal beds.
That's right.
I have to confess I have some experience of sitting on a panel with Mr. Potts, hearing the consent for the Te Anau wastewater treatment system.
Which is referenced in this report.
I understand, to some extent, the methodology required to remove, to reduce and minimise nitrogen, and the disposal of the land that merely transfers it from the wastewater to the groundwater, which then flows into the lake.
Yes. Unless there's a mechanism to volatilise the nitrogen out of the waste.
Yes. And that doesn't seem to have been covered, probably because it was such a small number of houses, it wasn't considered important. I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, can I say candidly that unless we can show that the inload would not have an effect on the natural character of the lake, that is plainly a red light, green light issue.
But doesn't it go to the urbanisation factor? If we have a choice of saying, yes, you can urbanise, and do your own wastewater treatment, are we then putting that on the regional council to say yes or no to urbanisation, which is not really their responsibility? Or is the submitter required to show us now that urbanisation can occur without those effects on the lake?
Well, there are two things that I want to say about that. Firstly, we're not saying that there isn't a reticulation option, only that we are wishing to understand ourselves that we can entirely self-service, because that is likely to affect the commercial position of the parties through whose land the waste stream would be reticulated. If I can put it as about as delicately as I can put it.
I understand all that.
The advice that we have is, yes, it can be treated and disposed of entirely on site. The question you ask is, what are the consequences of that disposal? And the answer is surely that if we cannot meet the regional council's requirements and the water conservation order requirements in relation to that disposal, then reticulation will be our only choice. And that is physically possible. It's just a question of the commercial terms on which that occurs.
Saying that, for example, you can't deal with this in nitrogen issue, there is an option to connect to the council.
Well, as I said in my opening submissions, whether the council will accept the receipt of that waste stream into its system is a decision for the council to make under the Local Government Act.
Yes.
What I am telling you is that we can physically get it there.
Physically, yes.
Yes.
Can I follow
that up?
Yes.
Looking at Mr. Gleason's rebuttal evidence, I got the impression that he was fine with QLDC system accepting this.
Yes.
I didn't think it would be an obstruction by him.
No.
Can I just back up entirely? Because in that part of his evidence, rebuttal evidence that you referred to, I think he says that that the calculations that were done on wastewater were based on 130 grains, not 715. Can you put me straight?
Well, that's the right. The low environment impact report was 130, and that was specific to a part of the zone. So we've calculated then the new demands for the larger zone. Yeah. Okay.
I just got a bit
crosswind
on that one.
That's right, but what we've done is adopted the findings in the low environmental impact scale for the new land.
Thank
That's
you.
Right, because in principle, how we deal with the effluent apart from the scale is the same.
But it's about the water supply, and I guess that goes back to in the summer you don't mention using the cone boom system.
That's
where it's got a lovely name, which is not at my fingertips at the moment. But yes, you don't mention that anymore. Has that fallen off the...
No, so we had discussed with cone boom connecting to their system. Under the agreement, there was to be a share for the water infrastructure paid. And that offer was investigated. The costs that Jack's Point had originally suggested was the contribution was more than what it would cost to establish a brand new system in a secure bore. So that's why we've investigated the alternative.
Well, that's the reason why I think our rent would be substantially varied.
Yes.
Because they're not creating that. Mm.
Yes, the cone burn scheme has tanks on the Roshima Tanay checkpoint. That's not the only option that the submitter has about where to create the tanks for. And so there are a number of options. Chris, I don't know whether you've got an optimal one of them in mind.
No, again, because again they have land on the other side as well, probably finding a suitable elevation that would provide for between 300 and 800 kVA in a location that is not obtrusive, I suppose. I mean, the further away from the site, a little bit more cost in putting pipes in, but again, near the existing Coneburn reservoir is equally appropriate in terms of servicing the site.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. The only other question I had was regarding stormwater. In paragraph 6.2, you talked about an integrated treatment plan approach. Is that a standard approach in the council's subdivision design guidelines, or is
council now in their code of practice promote low impact design as their preferred option?
Right, so that's essentially just the code. Preferred option rather than something special.
Correct. It's probably in accordance with their engineering codes as opposed to any bespoke system that would just deal with the stormwater in a normal fashion, I suppose.
Yeah. Okay. 15. I have no other questions.
Okay. That goes even brings us to Nick.
It does. Quite Mr. Bartlett, though, I did two copies. One that includes a revised chapter 41, which is somewhat more cumbersome, but as a planner I haven't quite figured out a way to get around that one. But in the front of, I guess, my attachment A, I have done a sort of cut and paste where I've pulled the rules that have been changed from the chapter that was attached to the right reply there for your reading as opposed to the entire chapter 41. The QLDC planner, Mrs. Vicky Jones, filed rebuttal evidence on the 11th of July 2017 in relation to submission 715, which clearly and concisely confines outstanding matters. Primarily, I would like to address matters raised in her evidence and where relevant matters raised by other parties. Secondly, I provide a summary of my supplementary evidence on the dwelling capacity model. Visibility. My opinion on matters relating to the management and protection of landscapes, including their character, from adverse effects of subdivision use and development, relies heavily upon the assessment and evidence of Mr. Espy. As confirmed in my primary evidence, I believe that based upon Mr. Espy's assessment and evidence, any adverse effects in this regard are acceptable. Ms. Jones finds the proposed rezoning inconsistent with the Chapter 6 objectives 6.31, 6.32, 6.34, and Policy 6.3110. I disagree, and based upon the assessment and evidence of Mr. Espy, I believe the proposed rezoning is consistent with these objectives and policy. Residential areas A to C are not intended to be visible from any visual perspective afforded from the state highway by virtue of the mounds located some 350 metres from the highway itself. I accept that this makes for a larger mound than would otherwise be required if roof spaces were to be visible. However, given the setback of the mounds from the road coupled with the landscaping as outlined in the evidence of Mr. Espy, I consider that the recommended mounds in time will appear more natural than any suitably recessive roof space. Ms. Jones finds the proposed rezoning inconsistent with policy 6.324. This policy asks whether subdivision and development constitute sprawl along roads. I believe urban sprawl as viewed from a road needs to be a sustained view of development, and in my experience this typically appears as an elongated pattern which is reasonably well aligned with the road. I do not believe proposed rezoning offers direct or sustained visual perspective of built form from the road. Therefore, I do not believe residential areas A to C constitute subdivision or development sprawl along the road, and the proposed rezoning is consistent with policy 6.3.24. The proposed mounds stand a maximum height of 4.5 metres, some 350 metres from the state highway. I do not consider the proposed height in relation to the roadside boundary as sufficient to compromise the current level of openness experienced from the highway. The land visible from the state highway is currently zoned rural general, where land practices often require large pinus radiata windbreaks, which I believe could reduce the level of openness across this area and views to Lake Wakatipu to a greater degree than the proposed 4.5 metre mounds. Therefore, I believe proposed rezoning is consistent with policies 6.325 and 6.343 of the proposed district plan. In addition, the proposed zoning offers a highway landscape protection area, which seeks to preserve a level of openness through the proposed district plan policy 41531, which reads, within the highway landscape protection area, planting and or growing of any tree shall not obscure views from the state highway to the mountain peaks beyond the zone. As outlined above, I believe the mounds are visually acceptable. The construction of the mounds and the landscaping is required by recommended policy 41512 prior to the construction of any residential units within areas A to C and D. I believe the discretionary resource consent assessment of the mounds, if they are accepted, as part of the current process is unnecessary, as any future assessment in terms of visual amenity, landscape, scale and nature could only logically confirm the same. The remaining assessment criteria for any earthworks consent application will be achieved through recommended policy 41.9b, which requires the submission of a construction management plan, while all works must be in accordance with QLDC's land development and subdivision code of practice. Ms. Jones recommends removing the requirement to plant 80% of the OSR or open space residential lots in favour of planting the gully area located centrally on the site within the OSF or open space foreshore area, and she recommends an amended policy 412126, which reads, ensure substantial native revegetation of the gully within the lake foreshore and the home site activity areas within the tablelands landscape protection area, and encourage native planting of the open space activity areas OSF, OSL and OSG within Homestead Bay. I concur with the intention and wording of the policy promoted by Ms. Jones above. As such, I have identified a foreshore gully area on the structure plan and included the recommended policy in the revised policy set contained in attachment A. Do you want me to stop there for questions on visibility, sir, or just to keep on?
No, I think if you go through the lot and we'll...
Rightio.
Questions may be wide-ranging.
Yes. Acoustic. Paragraph 3.11 of Ms. Jones' evidence reinforces the recommendation made in Scenario B of her primary evidence that the existing OSG, or open space golf activity area, has a better alignment with the existing end zone operation than the expanded wording of the recommended OSG, or open space, that's meant to be recommended OSL area. I concur with Ms. Jones, and I removed reference to the airport activities within policy 41.5.110 and amended the structure plan to extend the OSG area over the existing end zone operation. These amendments are contained in attachment A to my evidence. Paragraph 3.29 of Ms. Jones' primary evidence notes that there is no detailed mapping of the 55 DDA contour to the south of the existing airstrip, and the evidence of Dr. Charles offers a reluctance to locate residential activities within the 55 DDA contour. I believe the mounding around the residential activity areas AFC, coupled with the accentuated depression, is that residential areas will be located within may influence noise contours by comparison to any assessment undertaken across the existing topography. I recommend a requirement to ascertain the noise contours following the completion of the mounting and prior to the subdivision being included as a new policy in the subdivision chapter as 27.7.14.8. This proposed policy appears in attachment B. And it reads, following the construction of the state highway earthworks and prior to the subdivision of the residential activity areas RHB, ASE, an acoustic assessment shall determine the extent of the 55 dBH contour south of the existing airstrip. Should any residential sites be located between the 55 dBH contour and the airstrip, final consent notice shall be registered. Any residential building shall be designed to achieve an indoor design sound level of 40 dB/lbn within any critical listening environment based on the Homestead Bay noise contours. Compliance shall be demonstrated by either installation of mechanical ventilation to achieve the requirements in Table 4 of Chapter 36, or by submitting a certificate to council from a person suitably qualified at an acoustic stating that proposed construction will achieve the indoor design sound level with the windows open. Infrastructure. Mr. Hanson has reviewed Mr. Ulrich Lassen's rebuttal evidence and responds with further information and assessment in his supplementary evidence. Based upon the body of his primary evidence, supported by his supplementary evidence, I believe that effective and efficient infrastructure can be developed and the proposed rezoning is consistent with relevant objectives and policies of the operative and proposed regional policy statement and remains fully consistent with the purpose and principles of the RMA. Natural hazards. Ms. Jones recommends an amended rule 41.432 to account for natural hazards within the open space residential activity areas. Excuse me. On the basis that the residential buildings may precede subdivision and require natural hazard consideration, I have adopted Ms. Jones's rule, which appears in the recommended chapter 41 contained in attachment A. Traffic. Activities permitted under the operative district plan within Homestead Bay are anticipated to use Mary Jack Road and its intersection with State Highway 6. These permitted activities equate to approximately 244 dwelling equivalents. The evidence of Mr. Ferguson on behalf of Jack's Point Residents and Owners Association confirms concerns in terms of the safety and amenity for residents at Jack's Point with reference to traffic on Narragat Road. which is above that anticipated by the operative district plan. Based upon these concerns and supported by the primary evidence of Mr. Barber, policy 41574 seeks to limit traffic on Mary Gap Road from Homestead Bay to 244 dwelling equivalents. And this policy reads, only 244 residential lots or non-residential activity that is projected to generate the equivalent traffic volumes may be built within Homestead Bay area of the Jack's Point zone and utilise Mary Jack Road. I've not included JPR OA in this policy as I do not believe proposed district plan policy should require approval from third parties. Should an agreement be reached to use Mary Jack Road for any part or all of the 541 lots included in the proposed rezoning, I'm confident this would help facilitate resource consent approval to breach the standard above. Notwithstanding the above, I believe it would be extremely difficult to mitigate the adverse effects on the residential amenity of Jack's Point residents if Mary Jack Road was intended to service the proposed rezoning. Mr. Tony McCall's evidence on behalf of NZTA endorses Mr. Bartlett's primary evidence, where Mr. Bartlett has suggested the development of Homestead Bay is not to increase beyond the current provisions of the operative district plan without prior agreement of NZTA to establish an additional access to the state highway. The evidence of Mr. Ferguson on behalf of the JPROA confirms no opposition to a further state highway access point in principle, but remains concerned about potential adverse effects on the transportation network within Jack's Point. I did not include Mr. Bartlett's recommendation in the recommended policy set contained in my primary evidence, as I believe the proposed district plan policy 41541 will effectively do the same. This policy requires access from the state highway as a restricted discretionary activity, where discretion is confined to ensuring the safe and efficient functioning of the road network. Where a road is defined in the proposed district plan, as appears within Part 315 of the Local Government Act 1974, which includes public highways. I do not believe resource consent under Part 41541 could be obtained without the approval of NZTA. Mr. Barber's summary evidence discusses two scenarios, where the second recommends a separate access point onto the state highway with upgrading to the intersection of Mary Jack Road, which I believe satisfies concerns raised by Jack's Point Residents and Owners Association. Coupled with policy 41541, I believe scenario 2 satisfies the concerns raised by NZTA, and accompanied by the modelling that satisfies concerns raised by Ms. Banks on behalf of QLEC. Mr. Tony McCall's evidence on behalf of NZTA raises concerns with the reference to Diagram D in the standard 41574, recommended my primary evidence. As such, I have removed reference to this access point in the recommended chapter 41 contained in attachment A. Dwelling capacity model. A summary evidence of Ms. Kim Banks goes a long way to addressing the concerns raised in my supplementary DCM evidence, with two exceptions. Previous QLBC reporting. Paragraph 29 of Ms. Banks' evidence confirms the strategic chapters of the proposed district plan have been authored in the absence of accurate dwelling capacity estimations, yet paragraph 4 of her evidence reinforces that these chapters give effect to Part 2 of the RMA. I have reservations how strategic in the urban growth boundary is without full understanding of the dwelling capacity which it encircles. Development zones capacity estimates. The second table in Appendix 1 of Ms. Banks' evidence details 70% of the capacity to be relied upon in the urban growth boundary has been confirmed as realisable through discussions with developers who own a majority of land within these development zones. This results in only 30% of the dwelling capacity
to be relied upon in the further growth boundary has had the actual model applied to it. I do not believe this meets the intent of the National Policy Statement for Urban Development ASNI standards, which I believe expects a more robust assessment to confirm the actual realisable dwelling capacity. Reliance upon the advice of developers also appears at odds with the QLDC reporting on Council's lead policy for special housing areas, which specifies reservations about the lack of development within the urban growth boundary in the last 10 years.
Just in a number of places you referred to policies, in paragraph 11 in your summary, and also in your...
whether they were standards or rules or...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. Could you just clarify which they are, please?
Yep.
And what version? Because for me, I don't even know
what
version
they're referring to. Yeah. The requirement for a construction management plan, I've put alongside to that, which I don't think neither is a rule or a standard, but a policy. The requirement for the acoustic assessment in the subdivision chapter, I note the reference to Jack's point was provided only under the objectives and policies of the chapter, so seemingly it was appropriate to put it there. In hindsight, whether it should have been included as a standard to require it, but I don't think necessarily one would apply for a breach of the standard. It was more as an instruction. But in saying that now, and on the basis of the conversation the panel's had with Mr. Page earlier, it might be somewhat unnecessary. But yes, it's an objective.
Yes.
You see, to me, a policy is indirect. Policy is not something you can directly enforce, and it has to have, it has to be implemented through a related set of rules or standards, doesn't it? I mean, I noted this down too. Throughout your evidence, you talk about policy this and policy that and policy something else, and you never mention the related rule. Now, if the subdivision is a as a generic restricted discretionary activity, I suppose it doesn't matter. Because,
I'll just interrupt there. In general, I think the point the council got to with subdivision chapter 27 is if it's in accordance with the structure plan, it's a controlled activity. So it does become important.
Yeah, no, that's my point. If you rely on a policy.
I agree with you on the objective, and I guess. The advice I took from trying to discern it in somewhere in the subdivision chapter was based upon the other instructions for Jack's subdivision within Jack's point. So I'm not necessarily in defiance of making it either under the heading of the Jack's point or putting it in as a standard. But I'm not entirely sure. When you put a standard in, I guess there's expectation if you don't meet it that you will apply for consent to breach it. And I don't think you could, that's why I say it's more instruction that you undertake a noise contour study rather than apply for a resource consent not to do so.
You can always apply for a resource consent not to do something. You run the risk of it turning into a non-compliant activity.
Well, it just makes an interesting question, though, because what you're saying is that there's a precondition that has to be met in the zone, an obligatory precondition. I'm just not sure how you can frame a rule which has to relate to activities to be a precondition for the zone to get that effect.
Agreed.
There will be a drafting technique that can overcome all these problems, but I'm not convinced You haven't yet convinced me that you've got that to that point.
And like I say, it's not the only one that's already in there almost as a privilege. So,
but my starting point is that a policy is great, but as a policy, but it needs a rule before it can be effective. Some of those policies I read, read as though they were rules, and they're not, if they're policies. No, for example, the council couldn't prosecute you for not achieving a policy if, in fact, it was what you were doing was a permitted activity.
Yeah, so to have the rule, you need the policy. You need the rule, you need the objective.
The objective of the policy is to have a framework, and then you have the rules to implement it. That's all. And all you've talked here about is policies.
Yep. Okay. So where I stay, if I put the intrusive on the side, and I'll take a few of these other ones off the list. Policy 41.531.
Which paragraph number is it?
Paragraph 10.
That's a perfect example of one that looks like it was written like a rule. But the policy should say, you could have a policy about protecting the views from the state parliament. But I'm not used to having said words like shall in a policy. And again, it needs a rule before you can enforce it.
Can you help?
Let me refer
to 41.531. What paragraph
do
you need to
read? 10.
In the summary.
Paragraph 10
of
the summary.
There's no point where I put it in there.
To put that number in, it can't be a policy.
No.
To me, before we continue with the questionings on this, perhaps we could take a lunch and adjournment and then we come back. Mr. Geddes could just take us through each of them and identify whether they are policies or rules or whatever, and that would assist us greatly. So I'll adjourn until 2 o'clock.
Sure.